good afternoon, everybody, or good morning, good evening, wherever you happen to be. My name is Brian Hitney, developer evangelist with Microsoft. And we have a great episode of Dev Radio for you today. Very special guest, John O'Neill, founder, chief ninja at Sparkplug Games. No better way to introduce John than having John introduce himself. So, John, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello. Yes. Hello. My name is John. So, yeah, I've been all over the place. You know, I've been in the game industry on and off for about 20 years. Definitely a hardcore technologist, programmer, ninja part-time. Really have always enjoyed gaming and just kind of fell into the industry, like I said, 20 years ago while I was still in college. And there was a lot of interest back then, even more so today, with the, you know, widespread use of smartphones, consoles, web-based Commodore 64s, which are coming back, by the way. But I ramble. Hello.
Now I happen to know this because we've already talked before, but you've got a pretty cool history, at least for the old school gamers, right? Your time goes all the way back to the MicroProse era, correct?
It does. It does. So, funny story with that. A good buddy of mine, Wayne Harvey, who I worked with for a couple of years at a more recent company, he and I were in college together, and he actually got a job at MicroProse with a small group that was here in Chapel Hill. And this was back in 93, and I had an opportunity to interview as a junior programmer while still in school with a very interesting individual who pretty much quizzed me just on mining Python as far as my qualifications to join. So what is your name? What is your quest? And what is your favorite color? And, you know, I happened to answer it correctly. And the week later, I'm working for MicroProse, which was awesome because I was playing a lot of the MicroProse games. And, you know, silly me, I didn't really think too much about who Sid Meier was until I started working on these projects like, oh, I don't know, Civilization. And working with a small team there and going through the source code and trying to clean it up for the Windows version that we were working on, and then getting prepped for Civilization 2. And, of course, me opening my big mouth, being a junior programmer, thinking I need to prove everything to the world. You know, I'm reading through all this code in Civilization and going, oh, what is this horrendous crap? This stuff's not commented. You know, I got thousands and thousands of lines of code in these for loops. You know, the iterators and the I's and the II's and the IIAs. I'm going to blow my brains out. And, my lead programmer is like, well, you should talk to the guy who wrote that. We'll go see him here in a couple of weeks. And so we go up to the Hunt Valley office, and I meet Sid Meier, and we're chatting. Like, oh, man, code is horrible, dude. I mean, what were you thinking? And right about that time, I'm noticing everyone else is kind of laughing at me. I'm thinking, this is not good. And then it's like, wait a minute, it clicked. Sid Meier, founder of MicroProse, one of the greatest designers of the game industry. Yeah, don't insult him. But yeah. Very humble guy. You know, he taught me quite a bit, actually, just in having the opportunity to work with him on some of these wonderful games. And, you know, the use of code for prototyping purposes to find where the fun is. You know, at the end of the day, consumers, for the most part, are not going to see the code that we're writing. Mm-hmm. They want to see the end result. So Sid used code in a very elegant prototyping fashion to find ways of making things fun and then quickly experiment with features, and a lot of them stuck and they stayed in there forever. So that was the last time I made comments about someone else's code at MicroProse, at least.
So now, I mean, that's an interesting point, though, right, is that the genius behind iconic people, whether it's Sid or Bill Gates or somebody, the genius isn't ever looked at in history as having written beautiful code. It's right. Shipping a vision. So, of course, maintaining that and taking it. So you had to work on that code. Now, Civ 2 is probably one of the most iconic games ever, right? To this day, I'm sure people would look back at that and say Civ 2 is still. And I think, and I should go look through all the different app stores that exist in the world, that's a very frequently ported game, or at least very similar to that. Mm-hmm. There's so many clones of it now, but people want to take that that same model, whether it's called Civ 2 or a clone of the game, and play it on their phone or play it on their tablet, you know. So so that game still lives on. And
oh, it really does, yeah.
I think you said to me that was still one of your favorite projects of all time. Is that still the case,
absolutely,
you think?
You know, it's interesting when you work on, you know, any application, but in my case, games. And I probably touched over 70, 80 games in my career, you know, in various forms. But the interesting thing that I found, the longer you spend working on a product, the less likely you are to really be interested in it when it finally ships. But Civ 2 is one of the few games that I've ever worked on where when the game was finished, I still had those, oh, crap, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. Why am I still playing this game moments? And, you know, it was something where the balance was just there. It was an incredible game. You know, it was something of a great source of pride for us on the team that we got to be part of it. But then it was just incredibly designed and well executed. So it just caught you. And, you know, you start playing at 10, and like I said, you wake or you realize it's 4 a.m. and you're still playing the thing. And that's after spending over a year working on it, which is incredible. So
yeah, it is. It is. Oof. In fact, there's a I forget who gets credit for originally coming up with it, but the saying, I think there 4 a.m. You know, if you think about it. But yeah, that 4 a.m. moment where you've been doing something for a really long time. So it's I think there 4 a.m. So so very cool. So if you fast forward today, now it's amazing how different everything is today. And in so many ways, not just the technology and the processing power, not just the frameworks, and not even just the marketplaces, although all of it has created just such an amazing industry today. Mm-hmm. Gaming is also a huge industry, right? I mean, back in the MicroProse days, it was considered, you know, gaming was not serious, or, you know, it was kind of frowned upon as an industry. Now it's just massive. And so what led into Sparkplug? You started Sparkplug Games, and we'll get into some of the games in a moment, but what sure. led into that?
So, you know, it was 6 years ago, pretty much to the month, where I was working for another local studio with about 50 other people, you know, one of the local console game development groups, and a lot of really talented people. One person there in particular, a good friend of mine, Ben Licious, and I often talked while we were at the gym over lunch about, you know, how the game industry is evolving, how difficult it had been working on very large projects or very small projects, rapid iterations. You know, it's just a very grueling process trying to master a product to make it fun. So the schedules do get tough. But Ben and I in particular were talking about our interest, our personal interest in trying to find a way to balance a company in the game industry that still allowed for, you know, the fun factor, but not kill yourself in the process. So, you know, after a couple of months, we kept on discussing this, and amazingly, the idea was still sticking, where we were really interested in finding the essence of, you know, why we started doing this in the first place, which a lot of it was to have fun, to build games that were fun. And, you know, as a quick parallel, it's interesting you talk about, you know, how the industry started, and initially we built games for ourselves. You know, the game industry was developed to build the types of products that we as gamers who were writing the games wanted to play. We didn't really think about mass market consumers. And as you said, it wasn't really a widely accepted form of entertainment. So it's interesting how all these things kind of came together between the ideas of starting this company, getting back to the roots of fun, and 2008, when, you know, the best year for the economy ever hit us, like, yeah, I'll start a company. That's great. And then just our pure passion of trying to do something, getting back to smaller teams, smaller cycles, but still the quality level that we love building. And we kind of munged all those things together, finally took the plunge and said, what the heck, let's try it. Because we had the experience as game developers, we had the contacts as game developers, but we wanted to try the size, you know, going back to the early days of when it was, you know, less than 10 people building great products. So that was 2008, January 2008, we started it. And really ignored the economy. You know, the economy, you can't really bet everything on. So the interesting thing that was happening about that time is you saw more and more smartphones coming out. I think Apple released their little phone, and I think the App Store was just getting going. And we didn't initially look at that as a market. We were still predominantly looking at how do we build smaller iterations of fantastic products for clients, publishers, and then eventually ourselves. So we kind of juggled a whole lot of different things, you know, finding ways to do what we had to do what we wanted to do. And I can talk more about that in a minute as well. But gradually, you know, between 2008 to 2010, we saw the shift happening where we accidentally built a mobile game and kind of in this area got branded as a mobile game developer. And we were always like, well, no, we're certified for Xbox 360. You know, we do console game development as well. And we're always trying to shift that back. And then today it's like, wow, you do mobile games? That's awesome. Like, sure, we do mobile games. Yes, we do mobile, tablet. And it's become much more accepted as a form of entertainment, you know, by people who don't really think of themselves as gamers, but they still play a lot of games. And that has really exploded this industry. And you've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of new companies start just around the idea of building mass market consumer-centric products and no longer building games for gamers. So there's a part of the industry that's still focusing predominantly on traditional gamers, console games, and then a new part of the industry that's evolved out of what the consumer model has become, where entertainment can last and live anywhere, so why not go after it? And then we just kind of followed along the way.
Now, do you think a big part of that has to do with how everyone now is at least has access or really is a publisher? Because you've talked about this more in our face-to-face meetings, the importance of game publishers and marketing before. But now that every company from Microsoft to Apple to Google have a storefront where I can create a developer account and push an app out and reach the entire world in 5 minutes with my application. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's changed things a little bit where people are just kind of throwing stuff out there with ideas and you never know when you have the next, you know, whether it be Doodle Jump or Angry Birds or some other simple app and you don't have to worry about the marketing? I mean, how do you know, what do you think the importance is of these marketplaces that exist?
So it's interesting. There's a lot of people I talk to, a good number of students, some people who have been in the industry, others who are interested in getting into the industry, who think exactly that. You know, if you can go and very easily, very low costs, low barrier to entry, develop an application and put it out on the stores, they think, you know, that potentially will be the big win. And they typically find very quickly that you're not making any money. You know, no one's finding the product. And so the M word, marketing, really never comes into play. A lot of developers don't think about the marketing elements during development or even at the initial concept stage of forming a company. And they think, you know, let's just focus on building a game and then put it out there. And they think the App Store is going to do all the magic in the world for them or any of the online portals. And really the best thing to think of is your online portal, your distribution store, your point of entry where a consumer buys the product. That's just the deployment mechanism. All it's doing is putting it out there for someone to actually buy it. If you want to build awareness, you have to find means outside of just the deployment mechanisms to build the interest and have a following. A lot of these groups who do find success, they admit it was random. Mm-hmm. Or even Angry Birds, you know, they've been working, had been working on 50-some-odd products before they made that one stick. And they didn't do that one alone. They actually worked with Chilingo, which is now owned by EA. So for us, we have a very similar approach. You know, we will come up with a concept, and oftentimes we will decide, you know, what style of game are we approaching? Is this something that we want to do free-to-play? Are we going to go more traditional where it's a full-design product and you're buying the game? And you know, what is the game in general? And beyond that, you know, how do we get this in front of a lot of people? Or in some cases, we have a major announcement coming out here in about 2.5 weeks at Comic-Con, which I can't tell you about.
I'll hit you up on that in just a minute.
But you've got to find a lot of other things. And so one of the warnings I'll say as a small developer, you know, being an indie developer, if you don't have a backing of a major publisher, is that you have to think about that. Someone at the company, if not everyone at the company, has to have that in the back of their mind. And then someone needs to spearhead that and maintain that. We're fortunate because there's a lot of people that we've worked with who contribute their own ways of PR. You know, we have people who know Facebook really well. We do a lot of tweeting and Twitter stuff-ish. So they help in that regard. And then we build a very strong network of relationships with other developers or cool people like you guys.
Yeah, there you go. And so, I mean, so your point then really is that unless you're lucky, you know, some of the app devs can be lucky and just happen to get the combination right where they take off, right? They become that overnight success. But realistically, that's not likely to happen. You have to have a little bit more of a plan in place other than finishing an app and spending 5 minutes uploading it to whatever marketplace. So exactly. Let's pivot on that idea just for a moment, because you have some other things I want to talk about related to the marketing idea. But I happen to have here, I've got my Surface, and I don't know if that'll come through, but I'm playing actually, you've created addicts in my house. You've sent me over. This is Plight of the Zombie. I'll try to keep it a little bit open there. You can see here that I've actually cleared most of these.
Well done.
Well, I'm almost there. I'm almost up to the expert level. But my kids love this game, and I admit I've been playing it too. So you sent me over a preview of Plight of the Zombie, taken to Windows 8, and this is running it on the Surface RT, which is great because it runs really, really well. So I know that if it's going to run well on the Surface RT, it'll run well on any Windows 8 device, and so that's pretty cool. So the first thing is, so Plight of the Zombie is probably your most popular game. Would that be accurate, or would that be your most, I don't know if popular is a good word, successful? How would you describe that? What would be the best word there?
I would say, you know, given that we've done so many products, we've done some exclusively for publishers that have had tremendous numbers that we don't necessarily see a lot of. Planet of the Zombie was an undertaking of an independent idea that we took to market, and it was purely for mobile. So we started mobile only, then went to tablet, and now it's evolved to other platforms. And it was one of the first games that we really wholeheartedly jumped in and used Unity as a middleware solution, which was a fantastic discovery and something that I kicked myself for not doing sooner. But one of the reasons why it was so easy to get it running on Windows 8, one, is Unity just does it right. So it took us, you know, a couple of hours to take the product that we built previously that had launched initially on Android in a specific country. Tell you that story in a minute, too. And then converting it to other platforms. Now, I will definitely say that some of the credit comes to us for designing it correctly and making it very agnostic when it came to what platforms we were targeting, and allowing a foundation of a touch interface that if your device or giant monitor could support some form of touch interface or mouse, it was just going to work. Mm-hmm. And so in developing for a target platform which was mobile-based and an ARM processor for the most part, you know, we had to make sure that the optimizations for graphics, you know, for the AI that was in the game, and for all the other effects and whatnot, were really scaled to a point where it could work on a very low target machine. And then the interesting discovery for us, when we took and converted the game, say, to Windows 8 and going to a large resolution, it translated extremely well. The graphics came over very crisp. They scaled up to large resolutions. I think we've had it running at 7200 by 2048.
That's awesome.
That's courtesy of the Hunt Library over at NC State. They've got a massive 21-foot!
That's crazy.
Multi-touch wall, and we ran Plight of the Zombie on it, and it worked perfectly.
Awesome. That is freaking
really
cool. Yeah. It adds a certain level of immersion, I would think, right, to the game.
Absolutely.
You're seeing it that big. How important do you think Unity is to both you, Sparkplug, and then also the game industry?
It's real interesting. I got to know Unity actually about 7-ish years ago when I was doing business development for a different middleware engine. And so Unity was my competitor. And they weren't really a bad competitor because everyone in the industry likes each other. So, you know, we'd be on panels with Mark Rain with Unreal, and, you know, he might be bashing something about a console, but we're always talking great things about middleware and how we help developers. And so I'd initially looked at Unity, you know, for its feature set and capabilities at that time, and they were predominantly starting on the Macintosh platform. which I never develop on a Mac. So, you know, we support the Mac, but I just can't write code on a Mac. I get lost. So for a little while, a couple of years, I stopped paying attention to them. And then when starting Sparkplug, we actually used a couple of different middleware technologies, you know, some for console games that we previously used at other companies. I think we even used Flash for some of our early games. moved away from that. And then, you know, developed our own technology. But when we started seeing more interest in mobile and tablet, but always wanting to maintain that cross-platform capability, Unity started building more interest for us and for me personally. And this is about 4 years ago. Because at the time, we were kind of experimenting with our own technology between Xbox 360, PS3, PC, maybe mobile, maybe tablets. But it was still mainly console-based down to PC. And then we had the opportunity, after working on Puzzle Quest 2 with Namco, and that was all written native Xcode, which was crazy. But we wanted to be able to take some of our new ideas, and if we were spending short development cycles, you know, 3, 4, 5 months maybe, you know, we wanted to focus all our development on the content and not the technology platform. And so it just worked out where we had an idea for a 3D game. Plight of the Zombie was one of them. We also did a 2D sprite-based game. And we used that to say, let's look at Unity and see what it can do. And in particular, what can it do where we focus all of our effort on content? And that's where the whole kick me moment came. It's like, I can't believe how easy it is. Because you build and focus just on building great games. Because we're game developers. That's what we should be doing, is building games. So... And the whole getting to know Unity better, you know, like I said, everyone in the game industry is, you know, friendly. We all like to share for the most part. But the more we got to deal with Unity, we met more people, evangelists, sales representatives, technology developers at Unity. It's amazing how open they were to supporting every size studio. And so... you can see that, you know, when it came down to using the product. And, you know, I'm sure everyone knows everything when building things. But if you did have questions, say, for instance, then you had to find out more info on how to do something. You know, you go up and do a search, and you're finding content that the community is supporting. It's not even Unity having to say, this is how you do it. You see developers, millions of developers, out there supporting the product because it's so widespread and so accepted. So I think years before, Unreal had a very successful run in very much the same way. They were supported by the community. And so the community was able to show what's possible as well as feed that knowledge back into itself. Mm-hmm. It's actually something that I've always been very impressed with TechNet as well, just to plug back to you. You know, it's very easy to find information, and the accessibility of examples and answers to questions on how to do X, Y, and Z, far beyond what Unity may have initially thought of, is easily accessible. And so that kind of leads into today where, you know, you see fantastic announcements all the time about how much they want to support the growth of this independent spirit of game development. Was at the Build conference last week where Unity announced, you know, anyone who wants to build for Windows Store, Windows 8, you know, if you have Unity Pro, guess what? That's free. Mm-hmm. You now get that. I went, yay, woohoo!
Yeah, that was a huge announcement. I mean, that was really cool to see. And I think that's one thing that, to your point about them embracing community, has been so important, because it has gone beyond just Unity, but it is so vibrant from a community standpoint. You could see all the contributions people are making to the Unity, including templates and examples. So if you want to find how a particular game is built or find out how to do something, odds are somebody's done it or has been willing to talk about it or even build out a sample for you to do it. It's amazing how vibrant that whole ecosystem is. And then it allows you to spend most of that time on generating your idea, right? I mean, I'm putting words in your mouth here, right? But I mean, that would be right. I mean, instead of just worrying about for loops and if statements, you're really completing your idea. Yeah, exactly. You still have to write some of those, but you can take now. You can focus mostly on your idea and developing the content for that. And actually, speaking of content, one of the things you had said, which I thought was really interesting, somebody had asked you about how much time you spend writing the code versus developing the content, the artwork, the audio files, and how that breaks down. So do you have any general guidelines for that you guys tend to see?
So we spend a tremendous amount of time on content development. Yeah. You know, there's easily a 2-to-1 ratio for the most part, if not higher, when it comes to building the content, the 3D assets, the sound resources, the animations, you know, the levels themselves. And that's always been true for the most part in this industry, you know, in all the console games I've ever worked on. There's always been a tremendous art staff in comparison to engineers. But, you know, everything still continues to scale. So as the teams get smaller and the scope or the quality level of these games that we in particular are looking at, you know, what we want to continue doing is allowing teams with resources that are heavy on the art side to work with small groups of engineers. So we might have 1 or 2 engineers assigned to a project, and we have a lot of different things going on, but you'll have, you know, 5 to 10 art resources who are generating content. And a lot of that is, it's not just through the philosophy of, you know, build it quicker, but still keep the quality level. You know, for us in Unity, you know, going back to a lot of what we do, many of the development pieces, the modules that we build are reusable. So we may, you know, years ago have built a string table resource that allowed us to do, and we did, to do pretty much any UTF-8 based language string table that can be changed inside or outside of the game dynamically at runtime. So we built that system so that we wouldn't have to change it later, wouldn't have to evolve and rewrite it over and over and over again. And so we kind of try to keep that philosophy in place, very much a data-driven design, where what you're doing for each game should be specific to the game. But if there's components that you can pull from other products, that in general is a great pattern to follow. In Unity, we found it's extremely easy to do that with, you know, a lot of the ways that plugins are developed and designed. We buy a lot of plugins, we produce a number of plugins, but the modular nature of reusing pieces of code and even pieces of art, you know, allows you to really maximize that schedule and focus just solely on the gameplay as much as you can.
You had said something before that you do the things you have to do so you can do the things you want to do. Mm. What did you mean by that?
So, you know, as a business, when we started the company, and when I said that I'd spent about 20 years in and out of the industry, you know, there's a brief amount of time that I actually left through a layoff, working for other companies and other industries, as a consultant, you know, doing development for other types of industries. Actually consulted to Microsoft for a little while too, amazingly enough. But in doing that, what was fortunate, I personally got an experience in working with people who didn't know how to speak geek. They didn't know how to talk code. And so I'd always had the ability to communicate a technical idea to a non-technical person. And in starting this company, one of the opportunities we very quickly were given was working with a little company called IBM and doing serious games development specifically for one of the branches here in Raleigh-Durham. And at the time, they were doing something with that Second Life thing, which a lot of people thought was cool. And we, as gamers, kind of looked at it and went, ugh! So, you know, opening my big mouth, like, you know, why don't you take a game technology engine and use that for the 3D visualization of what you're trying to teach? Mm-hmm. And fortunately, they said, okay, here's a whole bunch of money, go do it. And so Serious Games was kind of part of our, you know, DNA from day one. And it allowed us to do a lot of very high-paying, high-profile products that the public may never see, but private businesses get a tremendous use out of, and they pay extremely well for that. So as game developers, that's not our initial desire, but it's something that we're very good at doing, applying the game technology, the middleware engines, the game design theory, the aesthetics of design, all those things to a client's need that has nothing to do or very little to do with entertainment. But we can charge a lot for that because it is a very specialized skill. So taking that idea of building things that we have to build things that we want to, building a game or founding a business on the idea of building games. There's a lot of pressure around, making money and keeping the funding alive so that you can keep the studio alive. And so for us, a lot of what we tried to do is find ways to balance that in doing the serious games with the entertainment games, but not have so much pressure on the games financially having to be massively successful. And so there was a fallback in that having to do the things to do what we want to do. And it's worked extremely well. You know, it's interesting how internally there's a balance between developers working on serious games and then working on entertainment products. And it's not a dedicated branch working on one or the other. It always mixes up. Mm-hmm. So it gives people an opportunity to really leverage, you know, they may come off a very difficult game that had tight schedules or, you know, constantly polishing for that fun factor, shifting over and working on a serious game that had very clear, defined goals and outcomes. So it's a good break from time to time as well.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine so, because the creative pressure, I guess, is off a little bit, thinking about how is this going to how are we going to monetize this, or how is this going to be successful.
Right.
And I suppose if you were to look at that, you said, you know, doing the things you have to do the things you want to do. If you were to look at that as like a Venn diagram, I would imagine you would have like this 90% overlap, right, where you're really not doing, it's not like you're out, you know, flipping burgers or doing things you really don't want to do. You're really creating core assets. You're enhancing your own skill sets. You're doing very close to what you would rather be doing, which is creating the better, you know, or the more immersive games. But but at least you're still working in the same tools. You know, you're using your same assets. So that seems
Absolutely.
Like a pretty genius thing to do. Now, the one thing that you did with Unity that I thought was really cool. I live in PowerPoint a lot more than I would care to, frankly. But you know, it's the tool of our trade. You, though, what was interesting is when you had to do a presentation, you actually found it easier to use Unity for a presentation than it is to use PowerPoint, which to me is I just can't understand that at all. But I thought it was really cool. And so if you wouldn't mind, if you have a demo of this, I'd love to just have you show this real quick, your thought process behind creating it and what the demo was for, or what the presentation was for, however you want to call it. But then we can take a quick look at it and any notes you might have.
Sure, absolutely.